Well, I think maybe that people who are less emotionally stable, they have more highs and lows, and so they're experiencing this wide range of emotion and want to express it. They see the world differently because of that. And because very often people who are emotionally unstable are often on the outskirts of society.
Right.
People, they're rejected.
So they actually have a vantage point.
Yeah, and they're not, and they don't have to conform anymore.
Welcome to WorkWise, the growth mindset for wisdom at work. I'm Ken Kennard of Accent Interactive, and my co-host is Mike Boies of Credo Consulting. So the other morning, we're having breakfast.
You have?
Well, it was cereal. I mean, this cereal is what you have when no one wants to cook breakfast and everyone's running behind.
That's true.
So my 8-year-old son says to me, he says, "Daddy, what's my personality type?" I'm like, "I don't know." And you know, we're both familiar with the Myers-Briggs personality indicator, right?
So, but how familiar are you?
But see, this is the question.
Right.
And so I just take a stab.
Right.
You know,
sure.
You are a, I don't know, an ISFJ. "No, Daddy, I'm an ISFP, of course," he says.
"Of course, Daddy. Don't you know anything?
And
where
this
have
is how
you been?"
Well, this is how I know that my kids have been spending way too much time with your kids.
With my kids. You know, I think you got it wrong. My kids have been spending way too much time with your kids.
Really?
I think so.
Why do you say that?
They're too happy. They're too happy. I don't believe in happy kids. I want sad kids. We always say in my household, there's no fun.
Oh.
And your kids bring fun. We don't want that. I'm sorry.
That's true. They do bring fun.
Yeah.
What was that sound?
I don't know. It was a fairy. You know what it was? Oh. I spoke an essential, fundamental truth in life.
That's the truth and in life sound.
Yes, exactly.
I didn't. So that explains a lot.
I hear it all the time.
I never hear that.
Whenever I'm talking.
Yes, well, that's the difference between us.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of differences between us,
yes,
as it turns out. So
yes, there are.
So I'm basically an introvert. You're not.
Hardly.
And I am very, you say I'm organized.
Yeah, you're organized.
And you're
driven to get things done.
Yes, exactly. And you are somehow not.
I am driven to consider ideas, keep them open.
Oh, my goodness.
Why make a choice until you have to? Now, I'm decisive when I need to be. I can make all the decisions I need to and very rapidly. But I also, if I don't have to make a decision right then, and sometimes I just wait till I have to make the decision.
Things could change.
I like to gather information. Things could change, exactly. Why, and why lock them in? Why lock into something if you don't have to?
So I'm on my honeymoon with my wife.
And I'm just wondering where this is going.
And I say to my wife, "This is going to be great. We're going to have a fantastic time together." She's excited too.
Yeah.
And I say, "How about we do this? Well, let's plan this day. Let's plan this event. We could go here. I had this list of really fun things that would be fa-." And pretty soon, as the conversation got going, she could tell that I wasn't just planning an activity. I was planning the whole honeymoon.
Yeah. Yeah, like, and let me guess, she deflated like a blow up ball. She just went, whoosh.
She did. And I could tell she was not nearly as excited about the honeymoon that I was so carefully planning. And then she used these words, "Don't box me in."
Yeah, exactly.
And then right then and there, I realized she is not my type either.
Oh.
So that's two people.
I'm not your type.
No. Oh, and, clearly.
And your wife's not your type.
No.
But we're bonded by your wife. Because your wife is my wife's sister. So,
right.
So we're. Is there anybody else that you're not, who's not your type, that's bonded to you by your wife?
Everybody.
You
know what? My personality type is only like 4% of the population.
I got you beat.
What's yours?
Well, in the Myers-Briggs typology.
Yes.
I'm 2.5%.
2.5?
And I have one of the other ones in my household.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, yeah. So as Gabby would say, I knew I was special. So we're seeing different personalities here.
And it's amazing how many different people types there are.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, we're talking about Myers-Briggs type.
Right.
And, you know, I had a funny thing happen a couple years ago in a class where I was introducing the typology and, or just the Myers-Briggs type. And a guy raises his hand. And I, of course, I called on him because I'm, you know, I'm very agreeable.
Yeah.
And he says, you know, I read somewhere that Myers-Briggs types is all pop psychology. And he meant that to be very denigrating. Like, oh, if it's popular, it can't have any value. And I thought, well, you know, Catherine Myers and Isabel Briggs would be cheering in their graves if they heard you say this, because they took Jung's psychological theory and thought, holy cow, this explains so much and it's so useful. We want the whole world to know about this because they're going to benefit in communications and relationally and insight to people. And the world's going to be great if we could just spread this to everybody.
Spread the love.
If it could be popular.
Yeah. And now that it's popular, it must not be valuable.
Yeah. Yeah. And so they would be happy. So that's what I told them. I said, well, you know, if the inventors of the Myers-Briggs, you know, type indicator heard you say that, they would be like jumping for joy. So yeah, it's popular.
Yeah, but it's not the only way to measure personality types, yeah. Right? There's all kinds of ways. Why do you think Myers-Briggs is so popular though?
Well, I think Myers-Briggs is popular because it has a lot of power and it simply explains differences that mm-hmm. people see between themselves and other people, and it makes sense to them.
Yeah,
and it also and it touches upon some things that they not just differences, but differences that matter to people. And because at our hearts we're all egocentric, we think everyone should be like us,
mm-hmm.
you know, and we kind of say to other people, well, if you're not like me, you're not quite right.
Yeah.
And so it kind of justifies ourselves and says, yeah, I knew I was this. And that, but also it explains you. And when it explains you and it's combined with, and this is normal, it gives people a sense of, okay, it's normal. Therefore, I shouldn't be so judgmental. Maybe I need to figure out a different way of relating with this and learn something to do with it. So I think that's what it's done. It's done a phenomenal job at that. And organizations use it worldwide. It's translated in I don't know how many languages now. And it's very helpful. It's very helpful for team building. It's great for figuring out what kind of career you might be interested in. It's great for understanding family dynamics. I mean, we had a thing with the homeschool moms where mm-hmm. they could understand their kids better. And, you know, why isn't this kid responding as I would? Well, because they're not you. And here's how they're different. And here's how that's normal.
And if you could take that information and apply it to your teaching,
right?
How much more effective could your teaching be
exactly.
if you accommodated those preferences and maybe yeah. played to the strengths of the child right. for the sake of their learning
yeah.
instead of forcing fighting it. Them? Yeah.
And, mm-hmm. and you know, teachers teach to their type kid.
Mm-hmm.
They think, oh, this works for me. This is how information should be presented. So I should do it this way.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, it's the same thing in the workplace. It's the same process in the workplace. Like, this is how we do things and
yeah.
everyone should conform. And
right.
it doesn't work so well.
Yeah.
yeah.
You know, I was thinking as you were talking about that I do a lot of work with people on creativity, you know. And I've heard people write about the creative personality type mm-hmm. as if there's a creative personality type, right? Right. But I don't see creativity as one of the spectrum, one of the measurements here, right?
No.
One in Myers-Briggs, you're either you're introverted or extroverted,
right?
You're either sensing or intuitive,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
You're either thinking or feeling
mm-hmm.
as a preference,
right?
And then you're either judging or perceiving,
right?
There's no C for creativity.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Is there a C for crazy thinker? Right, yeah. And so everybody, yeah. So, and as you said, Myers-Briggs is just, it's just one way to measure and kind of look at personality. There's other views, but there are different types. And there is, and what's interesting is there has been a tremendous amount of research trying to find what makes creative people creative. It's been like since the dawn of personality measurement, because creatives are so people who demonstrate great creative accomplishments are so interesting and they're so distinct from the rest of us that people are naturally interested in trying to figure out, well, what's driving them? How do you get to be this way? And so it's one of the most researched kind of fields is creativity, artists, as well as scientists, which folks who aren't scientists might not understand as very creative people, but they're incredibly creative. They're scientists and engineers are not the free-flowing spirits that we associate with like painting and sculptures and performance art and downtown, you know, the city. But they're creating new things that solve problems that we all have. And it's they go about it in a very investigational, systematic way.
Yeah.
And so what makes them different? Well, a lot of things make them different.
I picked up this book recently, Creative You. This is by David B. Goldstein and Otto Kruger. Using Your Personality Type to Thrive. And he actually agrees with me. There isn't a personality type. Right. They must have made him put that on the book. But
it sells that way.
Right. It must sell the book, right? Maybe it worked. I bought the book. But what's interesting about it is he doesn't just go through the Myers-Briggs personality types. He also identifies famous leaders, scientists, artists, and what their personality type was. And I think he goes through most of the 16. He identifies a key artist, at least one
in
or two.
Each
one of those to kind of make the point that you know, who we think of as creative people are actually all kinds of these personality types. But in fact, how that creativity is expressed, if you look at their creative process, it's very different. If you look at the product, it's very different. For example, Charles Schulz and Pablo Picasso. I mean, you couldn't think of too many differences, right? What polar opposites in terms of style and, you know, the Peanuts cartoon juxtaposed against Cubism, right?
Right,
France.
Yeah.
And yet they're both the exact same personality type, this ISFP. And so even though they approach things the same way, they're very different in terms of their product. Right. I thought that was very interesting.
Well, yeah. And I think it begs the question, well, what is creativity?
Yeah.
So how do you define creativity?
Well, I look at it as two things coming together. Mm-hmm. Okay. On the one hand, something that's creative is new. It's novel.
Right.
It's maybe even unexpected, right? There's something, if you just did the same thing the same old way, I wouldn't say that's creative, right? But then that's married to something else, which is it works. It's practical. It solves the problem.
It does something useful.
Yeah. And if you have just one of those, it doesn't work. Imagine that it's useful, but it's not new. Or imagine it's new, but it doesn't actually work, right? No one's going to
It's a painting that's not beautiful.
Yeah. Or it
it's
doesn't.
It's a rocket ship that crashes.
You tried to draw a rhino, but it looks like a pencil. You know? That's.
Have you been peeking into my drawing pad?
So creativity is when both of those come together. And that's why it applies, I think, to so many things. It applies to science. Mm-hmm. It applies to music. It applies to dance. It's doing what's intended in an interesting and novel way.
So what is in a dance? What's the problem or a usefulness of that?
Well, a lot of times in performance art, what you're trying to do is communicate something.
Right.
So the question is, how effectively was this thing expressed? Did it land? Did the message get across to the other people? Are they receiving what I'm trying to send?
Yeah.
And that's where it's effective or not.
Yeah.
If you're just being crazy and silly and it's interesting and new, but no one knows what it means or why you're doing it, then it doesn't work.
Okay. How about if it's just beautiful?
Well, beauty in itself can be...
It elicits the reaction.
Yeah, you want can be the communication. Yeah. I want you to experience something beautiful.
Or I want you to be disturbed.
Right. I want to provoke thought. Or I want to incite an emotion.
Right.
Those can be intentions of performance.
Right.
And in that sense, it can work or not.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So working or solving the problem doesn't have to mean mechanically solving a mechanical problem it would be if you were building a car.
But it might be.
It might be, yeah.
I remember my mechanic years ago, we had our blinker stop working on our car. and we put it in the shop and said, what can you do for us? It was an old car. And then she called me, the customer service person called me and said, you know, Mike, we could replace this whole thing for you, the whole shaft, and it would cost about $299. Or we can get a piece of rubber foam, fold it over and stuff it in there, and it would cost you 99 cents. And it would work just as well. Can you guess which one I took? Right. So that was creativity.
Yes.
They were the creative solution that solved the problem. It was novel. It was creative. It worked.
And not only that, but it also made you a customer for life. I mean, if you can get that kind of creativity out of that kind of person, mm-hmm. don't you want to stick with that person?
So, yeah. And so I don't know if commercials are prohibited here, but Rehex Lutherville Car Care on York Road in their seminary next to Friendly's. We love them. They're great. So there, a commercial, our first commercial.
And if they gave us the 99 cents back, we would have our first sponsor.
Oh, wow. Maybe I'll ask for that.
Hey, just something to shoot for. Yeah. I'm just the idea guy. You'd have to run
their
with it.
Their creativity was fantastic.
Yeah.
So the definition of creativity then is that you a novel solution.
That works.
That works.
Yeah.
Right? And interestingly enough, you know, when I look at the psychological literature on that, that's how they define creativity as well.
Yeah.
And so it could mean all kinds of things. Does all sorts of things.
Yeah.
Right? So when we look at that, so creativity is one thing that, I mean, that personality predicts, well, or doesn't predict, right? So, you know, is there a kind of creativity? So what's interesting about that is that when I went to graduate school back in the mid-80s, I went to a school which was fairly renowned, and they were renowned for, among other things, really psychometrically sound research, and in the field of industrial psychology is highly interested in figuring out what kind of person is going to perform well and what kind of jobs. And up until that point, what the research showed was basically that there's just basically one thing that consistently predicts success in jobs. And so you could like measure this before a person goes in, as they apply for a job, and figure out if a person was going to do well.
Let me guess what it might have been. So it's your ability to follow directions and comply with orders.
Oh, wow. You know what's interesting about that, Ken, is
you're about to tell me. I have no idea why it's interesting,
well,
actually.
It's closely related. So one of the earliest, maybe the first test that was ever used to predict a person's success in job was the ASVAB, which was the Army Service something, blah, blah, blah. I don't know the name of it. ASVAB B. And basically, it measured three things. And that was one of them. It was your ability to follow instructions. And they used that to select people into different ranks in the military, into different jobs. And so it selected your intelligence. It had a little more achievement in it. Mm. But achievement's a function of largely intelligence plus some opportunity, right?
Right.
So following instructions actually can be measured by other things too. So what they found was basically that intelligence predicts success in virtually every job there is. I remember when I was in school, they had found two jobs that it did not predict success for. And I don't remember the second one, but the first one was the guy on the street the construction crew waving the flags and holding the signs.
Like,
you didn't need to
Mr.
be
Mr. Semaphore.
What was more important to them for them was the ability to tolerate boredom.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Clearly.
So intelligence was not needed. But the guys on the runways for planes waving the planes in, intelligence was necessary for.
Okay. Well, yeah. So you're making decisions, right?
Right. So what the message was, or was mistakenly was by a lot of people in the field then, was that personality doesn't matter. And it's really just about intelligence, essentially.
Okay.
But the problem was, while it predicted, it only predicted a little bit of success.
Yeah.
In other words, there was a lot of other things out there that accounted for why a person was successful in their job that weren't being measured. And some of those the person brought in with them. And some of those things were the conditions on the job. And some of those things were the fit between the person and the job. So what was the most interesting thing about this long-winded story is that while I was in the bastion of advocacy for intelligence testing as a job selection procedure, there sat an older PhD candidate who was working his thing in his little tiny office consistently hard. When you arrived, he was there. When you left, he was there. His name was Murray Barrick. And he was working on research that showed that personality was, in fact, a very important predictor of success in jobs.
Oh.
And and we're going to circle it all back. And here's the thing he found. It's really common sense. And I don't know why no one really looked at it. He basically said, look, if you want personality to predict success in jobs, you have to identify very particular small facets of personality or combinations of them to very particular job conditions or demands of the job.
Okay. So if your job is to greet people when they come in the door and help them feel welcome and wonderful and happy, then you would match that with someone who's more extroverted, maybe a feeler, someone who loves connecting with people. You wouldn't put the computer engineer in that job.
But that's too blunt.
Okay.
So what he's saying is...
Even smaller grain.
So it would be... there's different parts of extroversion. And some parts of extroversion are sociability. That's the wanting to interact with people, being friendly towards them. And then there's another part that's initiating interaction with them. But there's another part that really relates more to dominance and being outgoing and pushing yourself onto others.
Ooh.
The kind of a dominance thing. And they're very different.
Yeah.
And so if you look at that, you might say, maybe it's really that so we want someone who's sociable.
Yeah.
And we want someone who's more affable or agreeable
right.
in there.
Yeah.
To be the greeter, along with maybe other things, right? And so what that was known as was situational specificity. And back then, we thought we could never get to measure and predict job success because personality was so, what they call it, situationally specific. It means it depends. And I thought, isn't that our job to figure these things out? Holy cow. And Murray was one of those guys who really figured it out and kind of launched the whole field in a brand new direction. He's a big star now. Mm. You know, he's a great professor. I think he's the last Solomon at the University of Iowa. Mm. So we learned that. And so, for example, like we know there's been a lot of research on creatives. And if you're looking at the Myers-Briggs scale, what they would call intuitiveness, which is very imaginative and openness and shows an affinity for kind of abstract and conceptual ideas.
Right.
That leads to lots of idea generation.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not worried about like particulars. They're just going to experiment with them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very important. It's kind of the creative side. But there's another piece to... There's other pieces to creativity when
sure,
you're successful.
Sure.
And one of them is being able to evaluate it.
Right.
And seeing if your pieces are hitting the mark.
Right.
And there's another piece which is that it's hard work.
Yeah.
Right? And it takes a lot of work.
Yeah. Ideas are like 1% of it. It's like the other 90%, 99% is the perspiration, you know,
that
goes into actually making the idea work. There's craftsmanship, there's artistry, there's discipline, there's the stick-to-itiveness to really see this idea. And then there's like, okay, it's time for feedback and let's go back to the drawing board and let's reiterate based on that feedback and do it again. This is not the same skill or task as ideation.
Right, exactly. And so what psychologists would call that, and depending on your language, they would call that conscientiousness. And the Myers-Briggs would tap that by a combination of being a sensor, an S, and a judger, a J. And so having that, which is hard because you know what? The intuitiveness is, at least in Myers-Briggs type, is in contrast with the S. So you're not what you're in Myers-Briggs, you're one or the other. And some research I've read about what's actually novel, if anything, about creatives is that they are at once have the ability to be that free-flowing creative person and then to sit back and judge and analyze. And that's what's unique about them. But there's all kinds of personalities that produce.
Sure.
Right. And there's different kinds of creativity, as you said.
Right.
So there isn't a type.
Right, right. And it seems to me we're talking about two different things. On the one hand, we're talking about personality as kind of like a neutral thing. Like And they even say in the Myers-Briggs, you know, this is not better or worse. Mm-hmm. An introvert is not worse or better than an extrovert, right? These are matters of preference. These are just how we're different. And so you can use these or not use these in particular situations and become more or less successful.
Right.
But then we're also talking about like the role of psychology in the workplace, it seems to me, is partially to try to predict, is this person a good hire? Should I hire this person?
Right.
Or is this a good fit for my team?
Right.
Or who's better is going to be at this job? Mm-hmm. Should I promote Jane this year or should I promote Francis this year? And why or why not for this? Mm-hmm. So it is really, it seems to me like the Myers-Briggs is really not going to help you in that case. You're going to need something better than that or
it's
different.
Not, yeah, it's Myers-Briggs is not suited for that kind of thing at all for a variety of reasons. One of which is its reliability and how they measure its reliability. So if you can't get consistent scores on the Myers-Briggs over time, then you can't trust it. Right. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't do a good job of predicting things.
But you can, right? On the Myers-Briggs, you can get consistent score. I mean, every time I take it, I'm pretty consistent, except just recently I became more extroverted for some reason.
Right. Right. And so what it does, what's unique about Myers-Briggs is that it classifies people into types.
Yeah.
Introvert or extrovert. And your scores on the Myers-Briggs are how clear you are about what you prefer.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not about how strong you are.
Right.
And virtually every other personality tool measures things along a trait dimension.
Okay.
Where it would be you're very introverted to very extroverted.
Right.
And there's all kinds of blends in between.
Okay.
And so you're not getting the same predictive power that because they're saying you're either
Got
or.
It.
And so if I'm just putting you in a broad bucket, I can get it right every time.
Yeah.
If I have to get it right at the same score.
Yeah.
Which is how we really measure reliability.
So what are companies turning to these days then for something that's better for hiring or
success? The latest thing that is really getting most of the attention in the kind of work world and in the world of psychology is what's called the NEO, which is based or the five factor model. What they've discovered, they use factor analysis, which basically does a lot of intercorrelations with itself to figure out what are the clusters? What does it really mean to it? And so there's five factors that most personality measures have been found to cluster around. No matter who made them, they kind of fit this model sort of. So I'm trying to get them right here. So the first one is neuroticism.
Oh, wow.
so either the scale goes from being neurotic and versus to emotionally stable, right? The next one's extroversion. So the scale goes from introversion to extroversion. Another one would be, openness to experience. And so I forget the other end. So openness to experience basically means that you are willing to consider new ideas and be flexible and wrap your head around them. And the other end is closed. So you're more conservative and conventional. So you're open to experience on one side and very conventional, conservative thinker on the other. Let's see, what else? I have that neurotic agreeableness. So agreeableness is that affability factor I talked about earlier. And that has to do with how agreeable you are to cooperate with other people and to meet their demands. So agreeable people are people who go along to get along, who show friendliness and excitement and energy towards other people. And you can see that, for example, that agreeableness factor would be very closely aligned with extroversion in Myers-Briggs psychology. And so that's one reason why the NEO is better. And the last one is conscientiousness. And it's always the one I have the hardest time remembering because I am probably the lowest on this one. And I should be more conscientious about understanding it. And conscientious folks just do what they're expected to do. They work hard. They persist. They're nose to the grindstone. They work through persistence and obligation, and they trust in authority. And
they probably check their work and make sure they're doing it according to the rules. And
belt and suspender kind of people.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's getting a lot of attention, and that has subscales as well.
Okay.
Those are the big clusters.
So on those big clusters, those big five, it seems to me that you've got a positive and a negative. Now we've got a value judgment associated with these things.
Yeah.
Because it turns out it's better to be emotionally stable in an environment like work than it is to be neurotic. Or maybe it's not.
Right.
If you go to a job where the task really would benefit from a high dose of neuroticism. Is that the way to think of it?
So neuroticism actually does predict artistry in a lot of ways.
Mm.
So if you look at people who are emotionally unstable, we can find a lot of famous artists who are depressed or who are manic.
Are there any that aren't? I'm just trying to think of a counterexample. I can't think of one.
Right. So in that sense, the artistry is really can be tied to not being emotionally stable.
What do you think that's about? Why is it that our emotionally stable people are creating for us such iconic ways of seeing the world, such unique ways of getting us out of our way of thinking and seeing what's really there in a new way?
Well, I think maybe that people who are less emotionally stable have more highs and lows. They have more highs and lows. And so they're experiencing this wide range of emotion and want to express it. And they've experienced something and they want to express it. They see the world differently because of that. And because very often people who are emotionally unstable are often on the outskirts of society.
Right.
They're rejected.
So they actually have a vantage point.
They do.
That they can use to look in and speak to.
Yeah, and they're not, and they don't have to conform anymore.
They're already out.
Exactly. So it doesn't matter to them so much that I've always been weird. I don't need acceptance really from people as much anymore. So I'm just going to be me. And oddly enough, there's this weird mix of neuroticism and successful creatives and artists is this neuroticism with this weird confidence too. Like I'm not accepted.
And I don't care.
I want approval. I don't care, and yet I do care.
Yeah.
And it's just they are on two sides of the continuum at the same time.
Right. What about extroversion? Because isn't it in the Neo that extroversion is seen as more positive? That just seems weird to me when we're using the same extroversion language to be neutral in the Myers-Briggs. And here it's like a positive thing.
Yeah.
So which is it? I'm a little confused. Do we just need different language or... is something else going on here? Are the introverts really just worse off for most jobs?
No, they're not at all. We can just take that statement out of the cuff. Writers, it's fantastic to be an introvert in a lot of ways because you get the focus and have attention and time, your own thoughts. Scientists, they're focused. A lot of scientists are introverted. People who create are very often introverted because they're engrossed in their inner world of ideas and they're highly productive in there. And they don't necessarily want people intruding on it. And they don't want to express things until they're ready to express them.
And it actually hurts the process to have a lot of voices in the mix during a time when they really need that focus.
Yeah.
You're bothering me. Can't you see I'm writing?
Yeah.
Get out of my room.
Highly engrossed in something.
Yeah.
At the same time, they need input at certain points when it comes to what explain to me your faces, your creative roles again, because that's a useful paradigm.
So the four creative roles that we talk about in Creativity Lab. So we've got the first one is the explorer. The explorer is the one who goes out and finds new ideas, new potential, right? The explorer, you can imagine, has the field glasses, the binoculars and the notepad. The explorer writes things down, collects things, even though he's not sure if he's going to use it.
Mm-hmm.
So the explorer is able to draw on this wide swath of experience and ideas for creating.
Okay, pause right there. And this is relating back to personality. So if we're looking at the Myers-Briggs, we would say that's an intuitive function.
Sure.
Right? If we're looking at the Neo, that'd be your openness to experience.
Exactly.
Specifically the adventurous scale.
Right. Very adventurous. In fact, you don't call someone an explorer who explores in their house. That's a homebody. So it's actually the farther they go and the more places and connections and people and things... the better. I talked to one creative who said his motto was look at more stuff and think about it harder.
Right.
I mean, that's an explorer leading that company, right? That's a guy who says more is better. And for the explorer, it's actually true that more is better. Because the explorer doesn't actually create anything. He's ingesting things for the creative process. And it's not until you get to the second role, the artist. The artist actually makes a few select choice opportunities into something, creates a draft of something. So the artist is going to go in and say, hey, I think this has potential. I'm going to see if I can create a draft and then we'll look at it.
Yeah.
So the artist is focused. I mean, if the task is to write, this is the writing part of the writing process, right?
Right.
Heads down, making it. If you're a sculptor, you're actually doing the sculpting in the artist role.
Right.
If the job is to create a website, this is the part where you're creating
it. It's the craftsmanship.
It's the craftsmanship part. And so it really doesn't have to do with so much how new is the idea. It's now about how can I make this idea actually work?
Turning it to life.
Yeah. How can I take this potential thing and make it an actual thing?
Right.
And that's the artist role.
And that's what we teach people. I mean, it seems to me that when we try to teach people to be creative, that's the thing people focus on.
Well,
that's what you think of.
It's the part that is easiest to teach, I would say.
Right.
It's hard to teach someone to dream and make connections and come up with ideas. Because it turns out that ideas just emerge.
Mm-hmm.
You don't force new ideas by will.
Mm-hmm.
What you do is you wait for them to show up.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not putting yourself in a posture where new ideas can emerge, then you're just going to be stuck with the same old ideas that you had yesterday. But when it comes to the artist role, now we're working on something that you can actually control. If I want to be better at drawing, I can actually get better at drawing by trying, by applying myself to the discipline, by doing what good artists can teach me to do. And that's why it's taught so much and emphasized so much as something we can control. And of course, as Americans, we love to work on things we can actually control.
Right.
That really gets us excited.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the distinction between the two.
Artist, creative.
So you have the explorer first.
Explorer.
Then you got the artist. That's the second. And then the third is the judge.
Mm-hmm.
That's another role in the creative process where you look at the draft and you say, this really has potential.
Right.
Here's what's good about it. And here's where it could be improved.
Mm-hmm.
If you strengthen this part of it, it would be much better.
Right.
And maybe even here's why it would be better.
Right.
So the judge is going to go back and offer feedback that's going to lead the artist. The judge is going to say, here's feedback that gives the artist something to iterate on, something to improve on, back to the workshop. Or it could be an outright rejection. You know what? This idea doesn't have the potential, now that we look at it, that we once thought. And this is a good idea to abandon for the sake of something else. And it may actually take you to the idea that is worth further investigation.
Right.
But this idea in and of itself isn't going to do it. It's
that
judge role that makes that call. Someone has to make the call.
Right. So I want to pick apart that real fast, because the first thing was the explorer.
Right.
And so we'd say we can easily see that in the intuitive scale. We can easily see it in the openness to experience scale and subscales. So then we get to the creative piece.
The artist?
The artist piece. And so there, what is that? So there's a certain level of stick-to-itness.
Sure.
There's a certain level of having a tactile, for some people, a tactile feel, because you're creating with your hands.
If it's not, then you get ideas. Yes. Then you're working in the world of ideas. If you're a writer, it's not so much about your hands unless you really are enamored with the pencil.
And if you're
it's
a computer programmer,
it's
about ideas.
It is.
And
absolutely.
If you're a scientist, it's about hands-on trying, experimenting.
That's right.
Things. And so you can see different personality types becoming more important depending on the kind of art you're in.
Yes. Right, depending on the craft.
Yeah.
So then the judge takes us to someone who's making decisions. And we actually have judging in the Myers-Briggs, don't we?
We do.
The J or the P.
Yeah, and I don't know that that's more, the judging is a kind of a funny name for Myers-Briggs. And that's really more about seeking closure, closing things out and moving on.
Yes.
And so you organize things, close them out, move on. Organize, close out, and move on.
Right.
So it uses the word judge, but it's not the same thing.
It's not the same thing, but I think what they have in common is that an artist doesn't know, wants to know, wants clarity. Is this right. good enough? Is right. the question they always have.
Right.
Is this good enough? Is it new enough? And does it work enough?
Right.
Those are the two subpoints
yeah.
of that.
Yeah.
I've never met a creative person that showed me a draft that didn't really at their heart right. ask that question.
Right.
Or they yeah. might come to it and say, well, yeah, I know it's not good enough.
Yeah.
Let's start with that. It's not good enough.
Yeah.
But what would it take to make it good enough?
Yeah.
How can we make it better? And that's the closure part that they're really looking for. Every right. creative process is incomplete until it gets to that point where someone says, let's check the box on this.
Yeah.
This is good enough.
This is dumb.
This is good.
On. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's, I think it's part of it is, I think maybe part of success as an artist is being able to close things down.
Yeah.
And move on.
Yeah. Although I would say that it doesn't have to be closed and finished to be useful.
Right.
A lot of incomplete works have been really inspirational for other
yeah.
people. So yeah. don't sell it too much.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that you're not yeah. actually done though. When, right. when the judge says it's good enough, you're not yeah. finished. Because now you have to send it to the fourth role and final role, which is the warrior.
Mm-hmm.
And the warrior, as the name implies, is willing to fight for the idea.
Mm-hmm.
The warrior is someone who will stand up and take a bullet for this because he believes this is good enough. Not only is it good enough, it's going to help people.
Mm-hmm.
So sending this into the world is a way of loving my neighbor because this is going to be what they really need. And so I'm going to promote it. I'm going to tell them about it. I'm going to post it on Facebook. I'm going to make a website all about it. I'm going to get this out there. I'm going to make a postcard and send it to 100 of my closest friends.
Yeah.
The warrior is able to take a bullet for it and
yeah.
say, you know what? You have criticism of it, but let me defend that.
Yeah.
You think it's not good enough. You think it's not novel enough. You think it doesn't work for your
right.
situation. I'm going to tell you that actually for the right situation, it
right.
does work. And here's
right.
why.
Yeah. And what's interesting, I've had a lot of learning around two of those things in the last 15 probably years of my life. One is how essential the warrior is.
Mm.
Because if you are a good artist or a great artist and you don't get it out there, it's sitting in your closet somewhere. You know,
yeah.
and my first realization of this was with our friend Elena.
Ah.
When she was a really good artist. She was a really good singer. She was
yeah.
impressive.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, she's actually better than people I hear on the radio.
Right.
So there must be something more.
Yes.
To this. And part of that is the warrior. Lady Gaga was a warrior. She did crazy things to get her art out there.
Yeah.
You know, people do crazy things to get the attention so people will see their stuff
mm-hmm.
and consider it.
Yep. I learned about this when I talked to my friend who's a filmmaker.
Ah.
And his very first film, he worked years and years and years to get it done and poured a lot of blood, sweat, and tears and tried to get funding and so on. He finally got the film done. So it went through Explorer, it went through Artist, and it went through Judge. And he thought he was done.
Ah, yeah.
And then he
Everyone's going to find this in my closet. Yeah.
He woke up one day and he realized, I've just arrived at the halfway point
mm-hmm.
of this creative project.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's time to switch gears and go into the warrior.
Right.
And he didn't learn that until he got
right.
there. How much better it would have been for him. And later it was better
right.
for him as he was more experienced. He realized, okay, there's actually more to the creative process than I thought of. And it's going to draw on different skills, different strengths.
Yeah.
And maybe I don't play all the roles.
Right.
You know, just because there's four roles to play doesn't mean I have to play
them all. Yeah.
So who do I partner with to get this thing out if I'm not a good warrior?
Right.
And that's some of the stuff we talk about in Creativity Labs.
Yeah. And that's, those are some of the essential tenets of teams, right? And how we do diversity in organizations is, you're not going to find everything you need in yourself. Like, it's very rare. I'm not going to say it never happens, but it's very rare. And so you've got to find ways because it's hard to be you and not you at the same time. I've been trying it for years, and so far I haven't had success. so you can't be all, so you find it.
Yeah.
And that's a great thing. So that points to this issue of both two things. Two simultaneous paradoxical truths. One is there's no creative type, but yet there are personalities that make you that are productive for becoming an artist or help you be an artist. It's which part of the artist are we dealing with, in what situation, what kind of artist,
right.
in what world,
right?
So it's very important. But there's another thing that you were talking about upon earlier that I think is very important. artists, on the whole, are or people who show high creativity, on the whole, are more intelligent than the rest of us. And that has to do with, I think, two things. The first piece, when you're going out exploring, they're gathering information. One thing that we know about creativity is it's fed by knowledge. It's fed by experience and knowledge. So you have to have lots of things to draw on, because we don't produce things from nothing. Only one person ever did that.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
he spoke and it existed.
It existed. The rest of us have to learn stuff and put it forth. And so the more you learn, the more problems you're able to solve, the more new ideas you can put together, the more ideas you can channel into whatever your thing is. And so learning has to do with intelligence. Intelligence is the capacity to learn. So I've been surprised to see people on TV and all these folks who are just darn smart.
Mm-hmm.
And because...
Why is that surprising to you, Michael? I mean, come on.
That's what I understood the fact before. Now I've learned, because I've seen up close in life now people who are creative, what goes into it, how much effort goes into it, all what you have to do. And now I understand that. Before, it was just to me people acting or painting, and I didn't realize that it took intelligence to do that.
I have a theory why it's surprising to you.
Okay.
And my theory is that we came out of the industrial age, where the successful people largely were the ones who could mechanize, who could make systems who could mass produce, right? And we trained people in school for that narrow skill set of following orders, getting in line, and kind of meeting the minimum requirements for what it takes to get the job done. And in the information age, that skill set is not the one that matches with what we need and where the opportunity is.
Right.
Today, the opportunity is for someone who can swim in a sea of potentially conflicting pieces of data, sort through them, make something meaningful out of it through analysis and synthesis, and then in another act of creativity, put it out there in the world using rhetoric and using expression and using language that resonates, and get it out in the world so that it can make a mark, it can have an influence. This is a completely different kind of workforce and a different kind of a society.
I think you're absolutely right. And I like the idea of that. I think there's more to it as well in my case. Well, so part of it is, I think you're right on. I think part of it in my case is just arrogance. Like, I'm not creative, but I think I'm smart. So this is a former view. This is not the current Michael Boyce speaking. This is a former one.
Got it.
And so kind of putting down that's silly stuff, or that's not important stuff, or that's for them.
Right.
Not for the rest of us.
I think it's interesting today that a lot of the really successful companies, especially in technology, are not just using design, but are actually being run by designers, promoting designers to high levels. And in many cases, a lot of startups are actually coming right out of the designer studio. John Maeda's Design and Tech Report supports this theory. He says that lately, the top 36% of the top 25 funded startups are co-founded by designers.
Wow.
And that's up from 20% in 2015. Yeah. So year over year, that's a pretty big boost in the companies that are being funded. We're talking about companies like Airbnb, Pinterest, Slack, GitHub. And even he notices that there's a lot more designers in venture capital firms, and that they're even going out on their own and starting venture capital firms. So this is really unusual to see designers now in a place where it used to be, like you said, undervalued and underappreciated.
Yeah.
Now designers are kind of rising to the top and becoming real leaders.
So maybe designers are the new engineers.
Yeah, well, you have to have good engineering in your design, right?
Yeah.
Steve Jobs famously said, people think about design as the way it looks.
Right.
But when you dig deeper, you realize design's really how it works.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I think these designers have a different maybe mindset than the engineers of old did. And I really like what I'm seeing. And I don't have full knowledge, but it seems to me that the people who were making these companies, who are building them from scratch, are coming at it with a design's perspective, which says that I'm not just designing a product. I'm designing an organization for people. I'm designing an experience for my customers, and it's all tied. And so they're taking care of the whole organization with a vision for the whole thing. And it looks to me like that portends well for the future.
So speaking of the future, let's wrap this up and get this thing out the door.
Wait,
come on.
We have to?
Yes, we have to. I want to know what should people do with personality? Like, what's the usefulness of personality indicators for the workplace?
What's the usefulness? Are there choices for me? No, I'm just kidding. Just kidding. So the usefulness, that really, I think it comes into two buckets. The first one is, and the harder one really is, how do we hire people? We use them to hire people, really. And I think that there's two ways to do that. One is you do a psychological assessment. You sit down one-on-one with a person. It's like a psychologist, maybe like myself or another industrial psychologist, and they give you a battery of tests and figure out who you are and compare that to the potential job and give the report to the client. The other one is you do analysis on a whole big job. When you have hundreds and thousands of people in a job, you do an analysis of that job to see what's required of the job, and then you find out what kind of personality traits predict it. The easier thing is with like the Myers-Briggs. So you use a nice, simple tool to help people figure out who they are and how they're different from other people so that they can work better as a team and so they can lead people better. Those are the two main categories.
Okay, cool. Well, you know, I'm the J. What I like most about these podcasts is actually checking them off my to-do list. So I think we should wrap it up there. But thank you so much.
What I like best about them is that we can keep on doing and adding information upon information, and then maybe we could edit it sometime. But we could just divide these things up into segments, and they can go on and on.
See, the thing is, somebody has to actually do that editing, and that really creates another task list of boxes that we're going to have to check. And it sounds like you're making more work for us. So.
No, we have time for that. There's always time. Just, you know, there's always a way to make time.
Look, we don't have time. I mean, if we just keep doing that, we would never get anything done.
I have lots of ideas to get out. And if I don't have a person to talk to.
Why don't you just quickly give me your best ideas and we'll publish those and we can get this out the door. I don't see the point in like delaying this. This has already been, like, how long has this podcast been?
Well, my best ideas come when I'm talking to people, and it's been, you know, it's been very interesting
been
the whole way.
You've been talking this entire time. It's like you're incessantly talking.
It's kind of fun. I hear myself. It's really great because I hear myself even better.
This has been work-wise, the work mindset, the growth mindset for Wisdom at Work.
And it still is. We have lots of things to discuss. Ken, where are you going? What? Did he hang up? Well, there's lots of things to discuss. We could talk about personality and diversity. We could talk about, you know, normal personality and abnormal personality, because there's the whole Minnesota multiphasic personality.
Thanks for listening to WorkWise, everybody. Check out the show notes for the stuff we mentioned, like Murray Barrick and the five-factor model and the design and tech report and even my post on personality types. For more information on this and other episodes, head over to creativitylabs.us. I'm Ken Kennard. Okay, bye.
For crazy people, we could talk about how that works in the workplace, and we could talk about, you know, cultural differences in personality, and we have all this diversity things going on. And so, you know, what if a Chinese person comes in, or a person from Minnesota, or a person from Florida, or a person with green hair, and there's all these cultural things and that affect personality, which is really personality, and which is really just diversity in weird kind of ways. And there's all